is Brother Roger Lewis, and his class is entitled The Mysterious Tale of Two Temples. Brother Roger?
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and good evening, my dear brothers and sisters and young people. Serendipitous is the word that springs to mind in terms of the sudden recurrence of the power in the ecclesial hall at the appropriate moment. Because not only does the screen come down so that you can see the slides, but I can speak ever so much longer now that we don't have to worry about the dark coming upon us. Now, tonight's talk is really based upon that passage in the second of Thessalonians, and it's prompted by an alternative view in the Brotherhood concerning where the man of sin sits in his temple. It said, didn't it, in that passage, that the man of sin shall take his seat or be sitting in the temple of God. And an alternative view, which has been heard even in the Brotherhood, suggests that, well, the temple of God is in Jerusalem. The temple of God has always been in Jerusalem, and therefore for the man of sin to sit in the temple of God means that, firstly, a temple needs to be rebuilt in Jerusalem, and secondly, that the man of sin must then come and dwell in that temple in Jerusalem in order for the prophecy of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 to be fulfilled. And what we hope to look at tonight, and as we do so, to marvel at not only our traditional Christadelphian viewpoint concerning this, but to marvel at the way in which the Bible brings together this story, is to go home convinced about the wonder of what, in fact, Bible prophecy is all about and how marvelously true it's been. So let me just start with something very basic and fundamental, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, but really it sets the scene for what we're going to look at tonight, and that's this, that you'll remember from the beginning of time, at the very beginning of the Genesis record, there were going to be two different modes of thinking, two different seeds, actually, and the Bible is going to talk about the continuous theme of Scripture being the seed of the woman on the one side and the seed of the serpent on the other. The one representing the thinking of the Spirit and the light of the truth, and the other representing the thinking of the flesh and the darkness of error. And these two ways, these two seeds, these two type of people were going to be set at contrast, the one against the other, down through time. And it all starts, you'll remember, in the book of Genesis. In fact, it wasn't very long after Genesis 2 and 3, when those two seeds were first revealed, that it was to be found that those two different types of people, reflecting two different modes of thinking, very rapidly established two rival systems that would be found to be in continuous conflict with one another down through time. And the name of those two systems was Babylon and Israel. Perhaps Babylon versus Jerusalem, but for purposes of our study tonight, Babylon versus Israel. But it's those two seeds, those two ways, who very early on in the biblical record established themselves as being in conflict. And in fact, what the Bible is going to do as it unfolds Bible prophecy is it will show that there was really a first stage to Babylon as the seed of the serpent power, principally found in the Old Testament record and matched off against Israel phase one, which was the seed of the woman in the Old Testament era. And that likewise in the new, there would be another Babylon and another Israel, but they would be but subsequent phases of the same manifestation of the serpent power versus the seed of the woman down through time. Now, I'm sure, brothers and sisters, that thus far we'll all be in agreement, and you'll know that this is all standard Christadelphian teaching. But what we want to show tonight is that that system of rival religion, really, goes right back into the very heart of the Genesis story, and that's what we want to look at, God willing, tonight. So if you come with me to Genesis chapter 10... just notice how the record starts. In fact, Genesis chapter 9. We'll start with Genesis chapter 9 because what we're going to find is that those two rival systems down through the biblical record have had two rival temples, and that the man of sin we're going to propound in the second of Thessalonians has got his own temple that he sits in that's got nothing to do with the temple in Jerusalem. Never has been, never will be. They're two quite distinct systems with their own rival temples of worship. Well, in fact, our story tonight begins in Genesis chapter 9. Because do you remember there was a very interesting prophecy given by Noah at the time of the end of the record of Noah's life concerning his sons, Genesis chapter 9, verses 25 to 27. And it says there, "And he said, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. And he said, blessed be Yahweh Elohim of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant." Now, do you know, brothers and sisters, there's a couple of interesting things about this very ancient prophecy given by Noah concerning the destiny of his sons. And that's this, that firstly, Canaan, which is really the line of Ham, was going to be a servant to both his brethren, verse 25. And then on verse 27, it's going to talk about the destiny of Japheth. But strangely, in verse 26, do you notice that it doesn't say, blessed be Shem? No, it says, blessed be the Lord God of Shem. And the implication of verse 26 is that Shem, therefore, must already be in covenant relationship with God. He's the Lord God of Shem. And Shem himself, presumably, is blessed by means of his association with the Lord God. And not only that, but verse 27 says concerning Japheth, God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem. Ah, now that's interesting, because what verse 27 is prophesying is that no matter how victorious the sons of Japheth were in enlarging their dominion, that their own hope of redemption lay in the tents or the tabernacle of Shem. Only through the tabernacle of Shem was there a means of worship acceptable to God. Only in the tabernacle of Shem could one find a priest through whom one could obtain access unto God. Only through the tents of Shem could any nation under the earth of the land of the people of Ham or the people of Japheth find the promise of salvation. Even Japheth had to dwell in the tabernacle of Shem if they were to be redeemed in that way. Now, why that's interesting is because of what happens in the next chapter. Because in Genesis chapter 10, you'll remember that it says this in verse 8. Genesis 10 verse 8 says, Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before Yahweh, even as it is said, even as Nimrod the mighty hunter before Yahweh. And by the way, part of the significance of the phrase a mighty hunter before God is that this man didn't just hunt animals. He hunted men. And the men that Nimrod hunted were those of the true seed of the woman. Nimrod is of the seed of the serpent power. And here is the beginning of the system of persecution that the seed of the serpent would launch against the seed of the woman down through time. He was a mighty hunter. Nimrod's name, by the way, means we will rebel. And he was the first great rebel against the true system of worship. And we're told in verse 10, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Ah, Babel. And everything began there, as the record says in verse 10, in the land of... why, the land of Shinar. That's an interesting name, isn't it? Does that bring back any other scriptural memories, brothers and sisters? The land of Shinar. Well, we shall see by and by as the record unfolds just how significant this beginning of things with Nimrod the first rebel was. Because it says in verse 10, the beginning of his kingdom. So he was a king, you see, Nimrod the king. The king of Babel. Ah, but he was more than a king, because if you come to Genesis chapter 11, as the screen says, you'll remember what the record says. It says verse 1, the whole earth was of one language and of one speech, and it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain. Why, in the land of Shinar. And they dwelt there, and they said one to another, Go to, and let us make brick and burn them throughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime had they for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower. Actually, let me read verse 4 again more carefully. Shall we savor verse 4, brothers and sisters? And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. And let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. Do you know, verse 4 is intensely interesting for two reasons. You'll probably know that the word Shem in the Hebrew means name. And what the seed of the serpent, people, or power are really saying in verse 4 is, let us make us a Shem. We don't want to belong to the system of worship over there with the seed of the woman. No, we want a name of our own through whom religion can be obtained. And not only do we want our own name, but we'd like our own tent or our own tabernacle, thank you. Not the tabernacle of Shem, but verse 4, the tower of Nimrod in the land of Shinar. Now you see, that tower in verse 4 was in fact a temple. It's a reference to the ziggurat of the city of Babylon. It's the first temple of worship that the seed of the serpent has constructed. And it's a rival to the tabernacle of Shem, where God's true worship had existed from the beginning. Now, by the way, there's something interesting about that tower in Genesis chapter 11, verse 4. Do you know that a satellite photo can show you the remains of that tower even today? The outline of the tower that was founded by Nimrod can still be seen by satellite photo today. But it was a very interesting building. It was known as a temenenki. And the site of a temenenki was interesting because it was built on mystical numbers. It was 92 meters wide by 92 meters long and 92 meters high. It was perfect in its proportions. And it had 7 levels. And if you faced the very front of the temple of Etemenenki, the tower of Genesis 11, verse 4, you'd find that each of those levels had a set of gates. And each set of gates was above the other as the eye, as you drew nearer the tower, the eye was lifted to another set of gates, and then another set of gates, and then another set of gates, as if the gates ascended into very heaven itself, as verse 4 says, let us build us a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. In fact, the Sumerian name Etemenenki means the house of the foundation of heaven on earth. And what Nimrod built, brothers and sisters, so far back in time, was a rival system of religion. And he wasn't just a king. He was a priest in that ziggurat. In fact, if you got to the very top floor of the ziggurat, there was a room dedicated there to Merodach and his consort queen, who were none other than Nimrod and Semiramis. And that top that reached unto heaven was the means by which Nimrod began a system of worship that rivaled the true seed of the woman. And it began at this very, very early stage in Genesis, brothers and sisters. The seed of the serpent already has their own temple, a city and a tower. And in that ziggurat there was a king priest, Nimrod, the founder of the rival system of worship and the original rival temple builder, the rebel from the beginning of time at the foundation of the world. Now what's interesting about that is this, because you see, it's only 2 or 3 chapters later on that we come to Genesis chapter 14. And just notice, by the way, even though it says there that we're going to look at verse 18, I just want you to notice for a moment verse 1 of Genesis 14. And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar. Ah, that's the rival system, isn't it? That's the rival power of the seed of the woman. And it's that power that's going to come against Abraham in Genesis chapter 14. And we're told in verse 18 that Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was priest of the Most High God. So here's another king, verse 18. And another priest. And you'll notice it doesn't mention a tower, does it? Or a temple, or a building in Genesis 14. No, there was no tower, was there, in which Melchizedek officiated. No, he dwelled in the tent of Shem, where the system of true worship was to be found right at the beginning of time here, in Salem itself. In fact, if you come to Psalm 76 for a moment, which is the only other place where historically, in terms of another episode of time, it's the only other occasion that the word Salem is mentioned in another episode in the Bible. And Psalm 76 is linked to Genesis 14. It says this in Psalm 76, verse 1, "In Judah is God known. His name is great in Israel. In Salem also is his tabernacle and his dwelling place in Zion." In Salem is his tabernacle, it says. The tent of Shem, that's where it was, brothers and sisters. The true temple, as it were, of the worship of God. And in both these occasions, Genesis 14 and Psalm 76, Salem will be known as the place where the slaughter of the kings occur that come against God's people, where the bringing forth of tribute will occur, and in both places there will be a king priest, according to the seed of the woman, who officiates in that place. So you see, what we've now got, brothers and sisters, very early on in the Bible record, we've only got to Genesis 14, and already we've got two king priests in two different temples. We've got a king priest in Babylon in a temple or a tower, and we've got a king priest in Salem in a tabernacle. And the fact is that the one temple excited the enmity of the worshippers of the other temple. It has ever been so, brothers and sisters, down through time, the enmity between those two seeds and those two ways. Which really brings us to the second of Chronicles in chapter 36. Because we're told as part of the outpouring of God's judgments upon his own people, the record says this: at the time of the overthrow, that the children of Israel were to be taken forth into captivity. Well, the record puts it this way in 2 Chronicles 36, and reading from verse 14. Says, "Moreover, all the chief of the priests and the people transgressed very much after all the abominations of the heathen, and polluted the house of Yahweh, which he had hallowed in Salem, in Jerusalem. And Yahweh Elohim of their fathers sent to them by his messengers, rising up betimes and sending, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. But they mocked the messengers of God, and despised his words, and misused his prophets, until the wrath of Yahweh arose against his people, till there was no remedy. Therefore he brought upon them the king of the Chaldees, who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion upon young man or maiden, old man or him that stooped for age. He gave them all into his hand, and all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of Yahweh, and the treasures of the king and of his princes. All these he brought to Babylon, and they burned the house of God." The house of God. "They break down the wall of Jerusalem and burned all the palaces thereof with fire and destroyed all the goodly vessels thereof. And them that had escaped from the sword carried he away to Babylon, where they were servants to him and his sons until the reign of the kingdom of Persia." And perhaps we see the full significance of the judgment of 2 Chronicles, brothers and sisters, that the champion of one temple, the temple in Babylon, came down at the behest of God and destroyed the temple in Jerusalem and burned it with fire and took away the vessels of that house. In fact, if you come to Daniel chapter 1, we're told exactly what Nebuchadnezzar did in fulfillment of the second of Chronicles chapter 36. And just notice how significant Daniel 1 is in this context. Nebuchadnezzar came down as the champion of the temple in Babylon, and he burned the temple in Salem with fire. And just look at the spirit of rivalry here, brothers and sisters. Daniel 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem, and besieged it. And Yahweh gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. Oh, did you notice that, brothers? This is the land of Shinar, to the temple of his God. From the temple in Jerusalem to the temple in Babylon. But you see, the phrase the land of Shinar takes us all the way back to Genesis chapter 11, doesn't it? And to the tower built by Nimrod at the beginning of time. In fact, do you know, brothers and sisters, that the very temple that Nebuchadnezzar presided over and that Nebuchadnezzar helped to build was the very same temple that had been begun by Nimrod in Genesis chapter 11. The same building. There's a tremendous continuum of time here. The rival temple to the true worship of God. In fact, in Genesis, in Daniel chapter 5, as you'll see there, you'll notice perhaps the significance now of Belshazzar's feast. Because you see, Belshazzar does this in chapter 5 and verse 1. It says, Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before 1,000. And Belshazzar, whilst he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives and his concubines might drink therein. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem. And the king and his princes and his wives and his concubines drank in them, and they drank wine and praised the gods of gold, of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. And you see, the drinking out of these vessels symbolized the triumph of one temple over the other. You must stop to think about Daniel chapter 5 and verse 3, brothers and sisters. Do you know that Babylon had conquered many nations? Babylon had conquered many peoples. And yet the one treasure of all treasures that Belshazzar asks to have brought forth on this occasion, as the epitome of all the triumph that Babylon stood for, was the vessels of Yahweh's house, of the seed of the woman in Jerusalem. Isn't that interesting? The one thing that he asked to have brought forth as the mark of his power, the symbol of his dominance. Well, in the providence of God, all things have a continuum. And if you come to Ezra and chapter 5, you'll find that the drinking out of those vessels spelled both the doom of the kingdom of Babylon and the doom of the king himself. Because in Ezra chapter 5, we're told this concerning those vessels which Nebuchadnezzar had taken into the land of Shinar and which Belshazzar had drunk out of in Daniel chapter 5. We're told this in Ezra chapter 5 and verse 13. But in the first year of Cyrus, the king of Babylon, the same king Cyrus made a decree to build this house of God. And the vessels also of gold and silver of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took out of the temple that was in Jerusalem and brought them unto the temple of Babylon, those did Cyrus the king take out of the temple of Babylon. And they were delivered unto one whose name was Sheshbazzar, whom he'd made governor, and said unto him, take these vessels, go, carry them into the temple that is in Jerusalem, and let the house of God be builded in his place. Now, did you read that carefully, brothers and sisters, in terms of what Ezra chapter 5 says? Just look at the key words here. Did you notice them? Because the record says that these were the vessels which Nebuchadnezzar took out of the temple that was in Jerusalem and brought them into the temple that was at Babylon But Cyrus would take them out of the temple that was at Babylon and bring them back into the temple that was in Jerusalem. Can you see that spirit of rivalry between those two temples, brothers and sisters? Those two rival systems? The one over against the other? God never forgets anything, you see, in the story of the seed of the serpent versus the seed of the woman. And in fact, if you come to Jeremiah chapter 51, we've got a marvellous little reference here that shows that God never does forget. He never forgets anything that's done against his people and against the true system of worship that he began at the very beginning of time. See, this is what Jeremiah 51 says, and reading from verse 11, it says, "Make bright the arrows, gather the shields. Yahweh hath raised up the spirit of the king of the Medes, for his device is against Babylon to destroy it, because it is the vengeance of Yahweh, the vengeance of his temple," it says. "The vengeance of his temple, set up the standard upon the walls of Babylon. Make the watch strong, set up the watchmen, prepare the ambushes, for Yahweh hath both devised and done that which he spake against the inhabitants of Babylon. O thou that dwellest upon many waters, abundant in treasures, thine end is come, and the measure of thy covetousness." And God never forgot anything that had been done to his temple. It was the vengeance of God's temple, says Jeremiah 51, that promised that one day Babylon would be overthrown. And by the way, with the overthrowing of the temple of Babylon, there would come, of course, the overthrowing of Babylon's religious system and the tower that dated all the way back in time to Nimrod the great rebel. And yet, we're told this in Bible prophecy. If you come to Zechariah in chapter 5, that even whilst Jeremiah 51 prophesied the vengeance of God's temple and the possible, in fact, the definite overthrow of the temple in Babylon that would one day come, at the same time there was another prophet that would declare that as far as the seed of the serpent were concerned, there would be another temple built to perpetuate that rival system down through time. Now, in Zechariah chapter 5, we have a very interesting prophecy concerning that matter of the rival temple. Because this is what it says, verse 5. "The angel that talked with me went forth and said unto me, Lift up now thine eyes and see what is this that goeth forth. And I said, What is it? And he said, This is an ephah that goeth forth. And he said, Moreover," and I'm reading now from the Septuagint version, "This is their sin or iniquity through all the earth." This is their iniquity through all the earth. By the way, I just want you to remember that word, iniquity. Verse 7. "And behold, there was lifted up a talent of lead, and this is a woman that sitteth in the midst of the ephah." Oh, there's a second word I want you to remember, sitteth. "This is iniquity," verse 6. "This is a woman that sits," verse 7. Verse 8, "And he said, This is wickedness. And he cast it into the midst of the ephah, and cast the weight of lead upon the mouth thereof. And I lifted up my eyes, and looked, and behold, there came two women, and the wind was in their wings, for they had wings like the wings of a stork, and they lifted up the ephah between the earth and the heaven. And I said to the angel that talked with me, Whither do these bear the ephah? And he said unto me, Why? To build it in the house." Sorry, I'll read that again from the Revised Version. "To build her in house in the land of Shinar, and she shall be established and set there upon her own base." Now, do you know, brothers and sisters, within 200 years of the prophecy of Zechariah chapter 5, the temple of Nimrod in literal Babylon was destroyed. Because this particular prophecy in Zechariah chapter 5 was given at around about BC 510. And just over 200 years later, in fact, slightly less than 200 years later, Alexander the Great came through Babylon. And by the way, what he was going to do was rebuild Nimrod's tower. So he ordered, firstly, that all the stones be dismantled one by one by one until the whole site was clear. The whole building platform was leveled to the ground so that Alexander could rebuild the temple of Nimrod. But the trouble is, having cleared the site, he died. At the crucial moment, Alexander died. And they never did rebuild the temple. As I said, you can see the site from satellite, but they never built the tower again. But Zechariah chapter 5 said there's going to be another house built in the land of Shinar. But you see, this is a prophecy about the building of a new house, another temple in the mystical land of Shinar. There never was another one in Babylon itself, brothers and sisters, not a new house, but there was in another place. The house of this verse is the temple where the woman lives, whose name is Wickedness, verse 8. And what Zechariah chapter 5 was telling us is that there was going to be yet another rival temple of the seed of the serpent power that would be seen in the land of Shinar that was not Babylon, but mystical Shinar, yet to be revealed. Now that, brothers and sisters, is a slightly lengthy but necessary introduction to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Because now, just see how the second of Thessalonians absolutely comes to life in terms of what's really going on in this particular prophecy and what's really happening in this story. And I want you to notice, firstly, just two or three key words in this particular prophecy. So we're told this, verse 3, "Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, the day of the coming of Christ, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that's called God or that's worshipped, so that he is God, sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is a God. Remember ye not that while I was yet with you, I told you these things? And now ye know what withholdeth, that he might be revealed in his time. For the mystery of iniquity doth already work. Only he who now letteth will let until he be taken out of the way. And then shall that wicked one be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming." Now, just notice two or three key words, brothers and sisters. Verse 3, a falling away first. Now, some of you may know that that word in the Greek is apostasia. And in the Greek parchments, that word, which we take in the English as apostasy, was used in the Greek parchments for one who was considered to be a rebel. There's going to be a rebellion. And that rebellion is going to be headed by one particular man, the man of sin, who's the rebel. Ah, but brothers and sisters, who was the first rebel? Why, Nimrod, who first, in Genesis chapter 11, launched a rival system and a rival temple and sat in that temple as a king priest for the very first time. There's going to come a rebellion, says 2 Thessalonians, and the man of sin will be revealed. Oh, and by the way, did you notice verse 4? That when he is, how will he be revealed and how will he be seen and how will he be known? Well, he will sit. Why, that's what the woman did in Zechariah chapter 5. This is a woman that sitteth. He is a man that sitteth, says 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 4. And do you notice verse 7? For the mystery of iniquity doth already work. But the eyes that ran to and fro in Zechariah chapter 5 said, this is iniquity. And now 2 Thessalonians says that mystery of iniquity is already at work, even in the apostles' own day. And when the man in Zechariah saw the woman in the ephah, what did the angels say about her? He pointed to the woman, he said, "This is wickedness." And 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 8 says, when this man of sin is revealed, they will point to him and say, "There's the wicked one." Oh yes, brothers and sisters, this is a companion prophecy to 2 Thessalonians chapter 5. So the burning question is, when was the man of sin revealed? 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. When was the man of sin revealed? And of course, one of the interesting things that's a clue that needs to be really included in any satisfactory interpretation of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is this, verse 7. The mystery of iniquity doth already work, and when he who lets is taken out of the way, the wicked one shall be revealed. And yet verse 8 says that the Lord shall consume him with the spirit of his mouth. And one of the great puzzles of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is that the man of sin is revealed at a time reasonably proximate to the apostles' day. The mystery of iniquity is already at work. And yet he's still alive when the Lord comes. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years later. Now, how can a man of sin be revealed shortly after the apostles' time and yet still be destroyed by the Lord at his coming? And the answer is, well, no one single man could they? Whoever the man of sin is in the 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, to fulfill the identity of the prophecy, he's a man who's alive for centuries. And he can only be so through a succession of men who carry the title of the man of sin. And when that man of sin comes, says the apostle, when he first appears, how will you know? Why, you'll see him sitting in a temple. Well, let's just start with he that restrains, or he that lets, or he that withholds, verse 6. You'll probably know that the word withholds in verse 6 is the same as the word letteth in verse 7. To withhold or to let or to restrain. There was something restraining the advent and the manifestation of the man of sin. Now, I'm going to give you some interesting writings here. This is the testimony of early writers concerning that phrase, he who now letteth. What did the early centuries believe concerning the significance of that phrase? Well, here's what Irenaeus said in AD 185. So how long is that? That's about 85 years after the death of John, the Apostle John. Only about 85 years later. Not long. 80 or 90. He says, Daniel 2, looking forward to the end of the last kingdom, the 10 kings who shall then arise, amongst whom the kingdom of those men shall be partitioned, and upon whom the son of perdition shall come. Now, that phrase, son of perdition, comes out of 2 Thessalonians 2, doesn't it? So when did he believe that the son of perdition would come? When the 10 kings arise upon the Roman beast, then we'll see the son of perdition, AD 185. Here's the writing of Tertullian in AD 190, even more clear. Only let him hold fast who now rules until he is out of the way, 2 Thessalonians, who can only be the Roman state, whose breaking apart and dispersal among 10 kings will produce the Antichrist, and then will that wicked one, that evil one, be revealed. He's talking about 2 Thessalonians, isn't he? So what they believed was that the power that was restraining the manifestation of the king of sin was the power of pagan Romanism itself that prevented Christianity from developing to its fullness. Here's another writing. This is Tertullian again. And just see how remarkable this is. And there is another great necessity of praying for the emperors, even for the stability of the entire empire and for the affairs of the Roman state, because the greatest force threatening the whole world and threatening horrible calamities at the very end of the age we know to be delayed by the continued existence of the Roman Empire. Therefore, we are unwilling to put it, the prophecy, to the test, which is why we pray for the delay of the Antichrist by favouring the permanence of the Romans. What they're saying, brothers and sisters, is that in those early centuries, people prayed that pagan Romanism might be preserved, even though they persecuted believers. Why would they pray for pagan Romanism to be preserved when they persecuted the saints, brothers and sisters? Because they believed that if pagan Rome ever fell, something much worse was on its way. And that was the man of sin. If that restraining power was ever removed, they believed that that's who would come. Cyril of Jerusalem in AD 305 says, "Moreover, the Antichrist was prophesied to come when the times of the Roman Empire have been completed." And lastly, John Chrysostom, writing in AD 389, says, "He who now letteth will let until he be taken out of the way. That is when the Roman Empire is taken out of the way. Then he shall come. And naturally, for as long as the fear of this empire lasts, no one will readily exalt himself." Exalt himself, that's 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, isn't it? "But when that is dissolved, he will attack the anarchy and endeavour to seize upon the government both of men and of God." Now, what we're suggesting, brothers and sisters, is that the early centuries of time were marked by a completely consistent belief that the restraining power of 2 Thessalonians 2 was pagan Rome itself. If that ever goes, the man of sin will come, is what they believed. And any other identification or interpretation of 2 Thessalonians 2 needs to explain, does it not, that if it wasn't pagan Romanism, what was the restraining power that prevented the man of sin from appearing? Because this clearly is what they saw, linked, by the way, to Daniel chapter 7. So where is the temple of the man of sin? Well, the first thing, as we've seen tonight, is that the man of sin is part of the continuum of the rival power of the seed of the serpent, which, since the days of Nimrod himself, has always had a rival temple. They don't need to go to a temple in Jerusalem. They've always had one of their own, have they not? The seed of the serpent. The very zenith of their system of opposition to God, focalized in one man, in one temple, even it was as it was from the days of Nimrod. Here's another reason. The man of sin is a development of the prophecy of the woman called wickedness, who has a house built for her in the land of Shinar. Now, by the way, there's a reason, isn't there, why the woman is the woman in Zechariah 5 and the man is the man in 2 Thessalonians 2. The woman is the woman because Zechariah chapter 5 is about the whole religious system that the woman symbolizes. But the man is the man in 2 Thessalonians 2 because this is about the leader of the system, the one man in whom is vested the entire power of the system as a whole. So the one prophecy is a woman and the other is a man, but they're both wickedness and they both have a house. And if the woman's house is in the land of Shinar, then we'd expect that's where the man's house is too, since he's presiding over the house of the woman, isn't he? So it's in the land of Shinar that we'll find the man of sin sitting in his temple. And in fact, the man of sin is parallel to the little horn of Daniel 7 and to the false prophet of Revelation chapter 19, both of whom are associated with Roman Europe, and therefore we expect the basilica of the man of sin to be where the little horn power was and where the false prophet is to be found. And that's not in Jerusalem, brothers and sisters. Most certainly not in Jerusalem. In fact, let me just show you how wonderfully this was fulfilled. Because the man of sin was to be revealed, as this chapter tells us, when the restraining power was removed. The taking of his seat in the temple of God, therefore, is not a single futurist event seen to occur in Jerusalem. The man of sin has been alive for centuries, and the question of where he sits in his temple becomes an issue that can and ought to be proved as a matter of historical fulfillment. So to take 2 Thessalonians and say, well, the man of sin will sit in a temple in Jerusalem at some stage in the future, is to take that chapter out of the context of a whole continuum of prophecies about the rival temple and system of the seed of the serpent down through time. So, by the way, I've given you a clue here, but so when was the restraining power of pagan Rome removed, and by whom? It's a good time for a question, because it's, you notice that the heat of the day and the advancing of the hour, that slight sort of, you know, depressing of the focus. So just, how was the system of pagan Rome overthrown, and by whom, and when? Can anyone tell me? Michael and his angels fought against the dragon and his angels. Whenabouts was it, and who was it? Who overthrew pagan Rome? Constantine. Did I hear Constantine whispered? Did I say that there? Constantine. And yes, it was. Why? AD 312. That's right. Constantine. What was the battle, by the way? Anyone know? For 10 marks, what was the battle that marked, that sealed the overthrow of pagan Romanism, AD 312. The victory of Constantine. Of course, he'd seen a vision, hadn't he? A vision of the cross of Christ. In the sign thou shalt conquer, he marched forth into that final dramatic battle that sealed the overthrow of pagan Rome. Now, when was it? Well, it was AD 312. Now, let me just show you how remarkably 2 Thessalonians found a fulfillment at that time. When he that letteth is removed, pagan Rome, then the man of sin shall be revealed. Where? Sitting in his temple. Now look what happened, brothers and sisters, and marvel. So in AD 312 was the Battle of Milvian Bridge. Pagan Rome was overthrown by Constantine, and he who now letteth is taken out of the way. It was a glorious battle. And he fought against Emperor Maxentius in Rome. The last battle that secured the overthrow of the empire, that it might be secured into Constantine's hands. Now, do you know what happened immediately after the battle? Well, immediately after the battle, Constantine immediately donated the Lateran Palace on Montecelio and the adjoining land of the Imperial Horse Guard, known as Campus Lateranensis. Now, by the way, the Imperial Horse Guard made a tragic mistake, brothers and sisters, because they sided with Emperor Maxentius in the battle. They should never have done that, because Constantine won, you see. And that Imperial Horse Guard, which were 22,000 of the most fierce soldiers of the Roman realm, were defeated in that battle along with Maxentius. And what Constantine did was two things. He gave the Palace of Lateran as a gift to, well, he wasn't really the Pope at that time, but the Pope say that he was a Pope, but he was the Bishop of Rome, Melchiades. He gave him the palace. He said, here you are, this is a gift for you. And by the way, there's a great big piece of land next door, which was the barracks of the Imperial Horse Guard. But what Constantine did was he demolished the barracks. He levelled it flat. He dismantled the Horse Guard and provided this large area known as Campus Lateranensis. And he said to the Bishop of Rome, he said, why don't you live here in the palace where there's a nice little temple just inside, a little basilica, and build a big one, a nice new one, next door on this empty piece of land. What do you think then? And so what happened is that Melchiades moved into the Lateran Palace in that very year, AD 312. 1 year later, Constantine issued the Edict of Milan that granted freedom of religion to Christianity, that it might pursue its course in the Roman realm. And from that time forth, the Bishop of Rome would wax greater and greater in power. And in fact, what happened was this. That very same year as the Edict of Milan, the Church Synod convened for the first time in the Lateran Palace as a cluster of cardinals to resolve the problem of the Donatist Schism. So here we have a meeting of the Church Council in Rome in the Lateran Palace within 12 months of Constantine granting that palace to the Bishop of Rome, in which he now lived. In fact, the Lateran Palace became the official seat and the residence of the popes for the next 1,000 years of history. They sat there, brothers and sisters. He sat there. He took his seat there. And in fact, what happened was that in that same year, they did begin to construct a new basilica next to the Lateran Palace on Campus Lateranensis. It didn't take very long, only took about 12 years. And in AD 324, the new basilica was completed and dedicated by the next Bishop of Rome, P- Pope Sylvester. And when he dedicated the house, he blessed both the palace and the house next to it, and he called them Domus Dei, which being translated means the temple of God. So when he that letteth is taken out of the way, then shall that man of sin be revealed, sitting in a temple within 12 months, brothers and sisters, of Constantine overthrowing pagan Rome. The Bishop of Rome was sitting in a temple, showing himself that he was God, sitting in a temple, exactly as we would have expected him to be in the terms of the prophecy of 2 Thessalonians. Let me tell you a little about St. John Lateran's. You might not have heard a lot about it, but it's a very interesting place. St. John Lateran's, which is the basilica that was built at the time of Constantine. It's actually the cathedral of the Roman diocese and is therefore the Pope's own cathedral. As the oldest and original Christian temple, it ranks first among the five basilicas of Rome. Now, by the way, I haven't made a mistake. You realise what I'm saying here. It ranks ahead of St. Peter's. This is the most venerable of all the temples of the apostasy, St. John Lateran's, because it goes right back on the same site to the very building that was built in the days of Constantine, when the man of sin was first revealed in that place. Absolutely remarkable. In fact, at the very heart of that place, at the front, by the way, there's some very large central doors, which were taken from the Roman Forum where the Senate met. Very imposing bronze doors that link St. John Lateran's to the Roman system of past times. But the heart and soul of St. John Lateran's is the cathedra. And that cathedra is the seat from which the Roman pontiff makes his pronouncements, did so for 1,000 years, and still does so on occasions. Now, what's interesting is, well, let me show you that seat. I think I've got a picture of that seat. So here it is. So if you go to the end of the building, you'll see that throne right at the end. Now, that throne is the cathedra, the seat, the chair, on which the Pope makes his pronouncements. But you see, 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 4 said, so that he opposes and exalts himself above all that's called God or that's worshipped, so that he is God, and this is how Rotherham translates it, takes his seat in the temple of God. There was something peculiar about this particular man, this particular religion, is it was to be associated with the taking of a seat. Well, there it is. That's the cathedral seat on which the Bishop of Rome sits to make his infallible pronouncements. And when he sits on that seat, as, by the way, on one in St. Peter's as well, he speaks ex cathedra as an infallible man of sin. Now, I don't know if you can see at the top, there's a dome. You see the very top of the dome? Can you see a face right in the heart of the dome at the top? Can you see that now? Now, that's interesting, because let me just zoom up on that. See, that's a mosaic of the face of Christ. Now, by the way, St. John Lateran's, from the time it was first built in the days of Constantine for Pope Melchiades and dedicated by Pope Sylvester, it's been rebuilt 5 times, brothers and sisters. The building that's there today is not the building that was there in AD 312 or AD 324. But that was. That mosaic in the dome of St. John Lateran's goes right back to Constantine in AD 324. And that mosaic, brothers and sisters, has gazed down upon every man of sin who's ever sat on that throne in that building ever since. Doesn't that make you shiver? That very mosaic has looked down upon every man of sin that's been there down through time, exactly as the prophecy required. And what I can tell you, in AD 312, when pagan Rome was overthrown, there was no man of sin revealed in the temple in Jerusalem, because the temple of Jerusalem was destroyed. But there was a man of sin revealed in another place, in the land of Shinar, where a house had been built for the woman, and that's this temple here. And lastly, what's also interesting about St. John Lateran's is that next to the basilica is the Scala Sancta, the holy staircase, considered to be the holy staircase, by the way, because they believe that Constantine's mother brought the whole of the staircase of Pilate's Praetorium Guard in Jerusalem and transported it block by block to Rome and to St. John Lateran's. You can only ascend that staircase on your knees. And when you get to the top of that staircase, the Scala Palati, or the Scala Sancta, at the very top is a place called the Sancta Sanctorum, which means the Holy of Holies. In fact, there's a sign there above the Sancta Sanctorum that says, in Latin, there is no place holier than this. And into that Holy of Holies, brothers and sisters, which is the most venerated place in all Rome, is the Pope's private cathedral, where he alone can go and pray. You know, I've got a booklet on St. John Lateran's, picked up at St. John Lateran's. And at the end, on the Sancta Sanctorum, it says that inside that most holy place, there are ancient relics, it says, just like the Temple of Solomon in Jerusalem, it says. It's a rival system, brothers and sisters, and it always has been. And that's where the man of sin sits in his temple, showing himself that he is God. You know, across the front of that building, incised in the stone, and not just on this particular version of the building, but on more ancient parts of it as well, are these words: Sacrosanta Lateranensis Ecclesia omnium urbis et orbis ecclesiarum mater ecaput, which being translated means, most holy Lateran Church, of all the churches in the city and the world, the mother and the head. St. John Lateran's, where the man of sin sits, has been a marvellous fulfilment of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And the man of sin appeared in the very year that he that letteth was taken out of the way. He was sitting in that temple, and brothers and sisters, he's been sitting there ever since. Which really brings us back to the story, doesn't it, in terms of what the Bible says. Because if you come now to Zechariah chapter 6, and now you see what it says. So we've got a king priest in a temple in the land of Shinar, who considers that he has a temple and a most holy place just like the Temple of Solomon in Jerusalem. But here's the other one, brothers and sisters. Here's the other side. Because Zechariah 6 promises, doesn't it, in verse 11, it says, take the silver and the gold and make crowns and set them upon the head of Joshua, the son of Josedek, the high priest. And speak unto him, saying, thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, behold, the man whose name is the branch, and he shall grow up out of his place, and he shall build the temple of Yahweh. Even he shall build the temple of Yahweh, and he shall bear the glory, and shall sit and rule upon his throne, and he shall be a priest upon his throne, and the council of peace shall be between them both. And so here is another temple, the temple in Jerusalem. And notice what it says. It's not going to be built for the man of sin. It's going to be built by the man whose name is the branch. He alone will build that temple, and he alone will sit in that temple, verse 13. And he will be both a king, he will rule upon the throne, and he will be a priest, he'll be a priest upon the throne. And the Council of Salem, the Council of Shalom, the Council of Peace will be between both those roles combined into one man, the King Priest in Salem's Tower. And God's purpose will be brought to pass, just as he has always intended. We won't turn up Micah chapter 3, but you'll remember what it says. Micah chapter 3. Zion for your sake shall be ploughed as a field, but it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established above the top of the mountains and exalted above the hills. And many people shall flow unto it and say, come and let us go up to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his laws. In fact, let me show you something interesting about two passages that bring together the same single word. And it's these two. One in Isaiah chapter 2, which is the parallel to Micah, shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of Yahweh's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. Have you ever seen that phrase before? But I wonder how many times Christadelphians have looked at that verse. Probably quite a few, don't you think? But have you ever seen this verse, which says in Jeremiah 51, "And I will punish Bel in Babylon, and I will bring forth out of his mouth that which he hath swallowed up, and the nations shall not flow together any more unto him. Yea, the wall of Babylon shall fall. And when the mountain of the Lord's house and the temple of God in Jerusalem is established above the hills, all nations finally will flow unto it, and not to the temple in Babylon any longer, and not to the king priest in Babylon any longer, and the one temple which has long been the rival of the other will finally triumph in God's own good time." Will it not, brothers and sisters, be when Salem's towers rise again, that finally there will be an overthrow of the temple of Babylon in the mystical land of Shinar, where the woman has sat and the man of sin has presided? Well, that's really the end of the story, isn't it? Because you see what it says in Revelation chapter 18. And now, again, perhaps another perspective on the significance of what's going on in Revelation 18. Because Revelation 18 says this. Revelation 18, and perhaps reading from verse 9 where it says, "And the kings of the earth..." Actually, I think we might start with verse 8. "Therefore shall her plagues come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she shall be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God that judgeth her." She shall be utterly burned with fire. Oh, do you remember that, brothers and sisters? Isn't that what Nebuchadnezzar did in 2 Chronicles 36? When he came down and he burned the house of God with fire? And now Revelation 18 is full circle, you see, because now this is the temple city in Rome that shall be burned with fire. Because you see, God had said in Jeremiah 51, it is the vengeance of Yahweh's temple, and God never forgets anything that's been done to his temple. And just as the temple of God in Salem had been burned with fire in 2 Chronicles 36, so the temple city of Rome shall be burned with fire in Revelation chapter 18. And there'll be a reversal of all that's happened in this controversy in past times. And by the way, when you look at this strange chapter, and you look at verse 12 in terms of what seems to go on and what seems to be traded in this city, "The merchandise of gold and silver, of precious stones, of pearl and fine linen, of purple and silk and scarlet, of fine wood, ivory, wood, brass, iron, marble, cinnamon, odors, ointments, frankincense, wine, oil, flour, wheat, beast, sheep, horses, chariots, slaves, souls," you'll find that they all relate to a system of worship. It's a temple city, brothers and sisters. And it's a temple city that will be overthrown, as verse 20 says, "Rejoice over her, thou heaven, and ye holy apostles and prophets, for God hath avenged you on her, and a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down and be found no more at all." And that's the way the controversy will end, when the rival temple is finally overthrown once and for all, and there will be no other system of worship. And Revelation, just to end the story, of course, in chapter 21 says, and in verse 16, that instead there will be another city, another four square city. It's a city that the length is as large as the breadth. And as we read down through Revelation 21, we realize, well, you see what it says in verse 22, "I saw no holy place therein, no holy sanctuary therein, the Naos, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple of it." And of course, what Revelation 21 and verse 22 is saying is that the whole of Jerusalem is a temple city, but there's no need for a most holy place, because the Lord God and the Lamb are the most holy place inside that city. And when Revelation chapter 21 is fulfilled, brothers and sisters, then there will be another temple in Jerusalem and another king priest, and the story will have come to an end. And I think the marvellous thing about all that, brothers and sisters, is the tremendous confidence we can have in the work of prophecy as it unfolds itself and as we see it coming to fulfilment, that we can be so certain that what God has promised is going to come to pass. And we need to live our lives in expectation of the imminent return of the king priest of Zechariah chapter 6, who's going to come and build the temple and sit there as a king priest in that place. How certain we can be of those things yet to come to pass because of the marvellous way that things have been fulfilled in previous times. It's a sure word of prophecy, brothers and sisters, and one that we should be thankful for, one that gives us confidence to look to the future, when in the words of a hymn it says, "The beams that shine from Zion's hill shall lighten every land. The king who reigns in Salem's towers shall all the world command."